Okay, good morning, everyone, or good morning here, anyway. I hope you can hear me all right, wherever you are. This, as you know, excellent, is the first of the weekly office hours associated with the Patent Law and Global Public Health course. The purpose of these office hours is to enable you to ask me questions about the logistics, and even more importantly, as we proceed through the course, the substance of the materials that the course covers. So there's no agenda for these meetings. As those of you familiar with office hours know, they're intentionally free-for-alls, designed to enable me to answer your questions. One of the reasons why we're doing them in Zoom format like this is that several of you are likely to have concerns that are widely shared, and that by raising them, my attempting to answer them, we will address questions other people might have. Okay, so here's how we're going to proceed. Without further ado, I'm going to open the floor for questions. You can either ask a question by raising your hand using the raise hand function in Zoom, which most of you know is on one of the menus down at the, typically the bottom of your screen. There's a little icon that says reactions. And if you click on that, it will have a variety of icons available to you. And one of them is the raise hand function. So if you click on that, then your name will move to the top of the list on my screen. And you can ask a question. The alternative way of asking a question is to submit it in writing in the chat. Okay, so who wants to start? So I'm going to ask each person, when you ask a question, to, if possible, turn on your screen so that I and the other folks can see you. That may not be always possible, but if possible, please do that. And the other is to briefly introduce yourself. So Misty Napier has a hand up.
Yes. Hello. I am Misty. My question this morning would be, I know that when we went, when we listened to your recorded lectures, you had some slides. I was just curious if you will be sharing those slides.
I could. They, of course, are all available in the recorded lecture, but would you prefer to have them in a format that you could, I suppose, download and review at your leisure?
I would, and the only reason I would is because I like to download them and like take notes on, you know, there may be something that I can, you know, as I'm going through them, I can put into that particular screen, and it's kind of like a reference to me.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that's a good idea. So what I will do then is post on the regular syllabus for the course a slide deck. And I won't put all the slides in there because some of them are you know, pictures meant to be illustrative of events, or and some of them are cumulative, meaning that they gradually sure. build over time. But I will so I will put what I expect will be the substantive slides of the sort you were referring to up for yeah. each of the lectures.
Okay, that would be great, because I know, like, from this past week's lectures, you know, some of the things I was trying to type or write down as you were going through the lecture, and it would have been easier if I'd have had the slide and I could, you know, could have written something on there versus having to try to type it all down at my thoughts as you're going along. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good idea. I'll do that.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. So I'm.
Yes. Hello, Professor. Hello, everyone. This is Saad Assam from Egypt. My question related to the material of the course. So going through the material across the modules, I realized that there are some too long materials to go through it in details. So my question is, should we be aware of each detail of the material? For example, the court judgments and not the articles, mainly the judge articles, the judge, the court judgments. So it's too long to be studied in details and to be aware of each detail of it. So maybe we can summarize it or have some notes on them instead of studying them all.
Yeah, okay, so that's a very good question. It's a difficult question to answer. So for the purposes of the, I got for a second. You were a diverse group and different members of the participants, there are 500 of you, have different ambitions. Some are encountering patent law for the first time. Some are very experienced in administering patent law. Some are encountering questions of public health for the first time, and some are very experienced. And the things that the various participants want to get out of the course are also quite diverse. So, in answer to your question, I have included in the syllabus enough material to address the diverse interests of the diverse student body. That doesn't mean that every student has to read everything. The only components of the course that are essential in order to pass the exam are the recorded lectures. Those are very important. And Misty's question, or my response to Misty's question, should facilitate you using those materials. When you get past the recorded lecture, then which combination of materials is most useful for you will vary with your own interests and with your trainer's interests. So the 20 trainers of the course have different orientations, and that's deliberate. You know, so preserving some discretion in the trainers to shape their sections as they wish is quite important. And he or she should give you guidance as to which things to pay attention to and which you don't have to. So let's take an example here. This coming week, meaning week two, week three is coming up, there are two pieces of the recorded lecture that are required and one that's optional. The one that's optional describes in detail some recent developments in the United States and some developed countries concerning shrinkage of the coverage of copy of patent law. So you, because it's labeled optional, obviously, you don't have to watch that. It's not necessary. Then when you get to the reading materials, there are two possibilities. One is to read several short, intentionally short pieces describing software patents in different jurisdictions. And the other is to focus on the TRIPS agreement and the recorded interview with Jayashree Watal. Your trainer should be sending you an email message indicating which of those paths he or she plans to go down. So the upshot is that on your own, you can engage in triage, meaning decide what's more important, what's important, what's not. And even more importantly, you can get guidance from your trainer. And that should reduce the load to manageable levels.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Mateo, you're next.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your time first. And second, my name is Mateo Escobar. I'm from Colombia. I'm an IP lawyer. And I have two questions. So the first one is related to the discount that developing countries have, the 90% discount. And I'm guessing, or I'm asking, if that discount really impacts on the application that those countries made to the PCT. And the second one is why the TRIPS agreement is the most important international legal body if only sees IP as a tradable good.
Yeah. So with respect to the first question, the machinery of the PCT doesn't vary significantly by country. One can employ it to submit a PCT application from anywhere, including by default through Geneva. And so the machinery doesn't vary. Now, the PCT, as you know from the recorded materials for this preceding week, is expensive. And so it's not optimal for all folks, all inventors or firms in developing countries like Colombia, but it's available. Now, your second question is a big and important question. And Jayashree Watal's discussion for this coming week will address it. She, as you may know, if you've taken a look at the interview, or so I hope you will take a look at the interview, she negotiated on behalf of India, the TRIPS agreement. So she was deeply involved in the shaping of that document. Her view is that most low and middle income countries, which definitely included at the time India and includes Colombia, were disadvantaged by the TRIPS agreement, meaning were obliged to adopt higher levels of patent protection than would be optimal for their own economies and societies. So why? Why did they do it? Well, in most cases, she argues, because as a practical matter, refusing to sign TRIPS would have meant removing the country from the World Trade Organization, which was that just then coming into formation. And TRIPS was a precondition of membership in the World Trade Organization. And developing countries, so if we take Colombia and Latin America, were intensely interested in expanding the markets for their agricultural goods and textiles. And intellectual property was not seen as a big deal at the time in comparison to the important economic importance of gaining access to those markets. And so they did. Now, you ask a further question, which is, if I remember correctly, why is it the most important of the intellectual property agreements? The answer to that is that it has the most teeth. It constrains every country in the world, including Colombia, more tightly than it was true of any other agreement. So its only rival in this respect is the Paris Convention, the predecessor to TRIPS. But the Paris Convention is much looser in its structure and does not impose upon member countries as tight a set of constraints. TRIPS is much more binding. Now, it's not permanently binding. So one of the main themes that we're going to be discussing in this course is so-called TRIPS flexibilities, which are zones of discretion that are still left to all countries, including developing countries, to make adjustments, in particular, to address health emergencies. So—
Yeah, sorry. My bad. Sorry.
That's okay.
Because if we check back in time, like Paris Convention and Bern Convention beholds not only the right to exploit, or they behold also like the person and maybe moral rights in Bern Convention. When I see TRIPS agreement, it's only like you are like treating IP as a merchandise.
Yeah.
They're leaving the other aspects of creating and everything that is attached to the, I don't know, to the soul of the creator, to have some words to describe that. So for me, I know it's the most important because you can enforce it really, really better and almost in all the countries, as you told me, was a previous request if you want to be part of the trade commerce, what is the OMC. And so I feel that they forget about the other aspects that was taken in the creation of the invention or the, I don't know, a book or something like that.
That's true. You're right about all of those things. So why? Well, in part, it's because the TRIPS agreement was, as you know, negotiated as part of the GATT, as part of a pre-existing international arrangement that was solely focused on trade. And the alternative to the GATT was the World Intellectual Property Organization, the organization that's sponsoring this course. But many of the firms, pharmaceutical firms especially, but not exclusively, and many of the countries that wanted stronger intellectual property protection were not happy with WIPO. They didn't think WIPO was sufficiently attentive to their needs, in part because WIPO has a voting system of one country, one vote. So it's harder for developed countries to secure arrangements of the sort they would like. So they turn instead to the GATT, which is a trade organization. So it's not super surprising that they focused on trade-related aspects of intellectual property. Now, a copyright, a whole nother universe of legal rights that are covered by the TRIPS agreement, does, as you indicate, affect lots of dimensions of culture that are not fairly described as aspects of trade. And so the poor fit between TRIPS and the ambit of copyright is greater than the poor fit between the TRIPS and the ambit of patents. There is one respect in which the TRIPS agreement as it bears on copyright recognizes this, which is, you mentioned moral rights, common in continental Europe and Latin America. The only exception to the enforcement provisions of TRIPS concerns moral rights. Countries are left free as a practical matter by the enforcement provisions of TRIPS to decide how much they're going to protect moral rights or not. And indeed, some jurisdictions like the United States are definitely not in compliance with the Bern Convention. So there is built into TRIPS a little bit of recognition that TRIPS, because it only deals with trade-related issues, does not cover the entire landscape of intellectual property.
For me, I'm going to end with this. Like, for me, it's ironic that the most important IP convention or agreement is related to the commerce and not for WIPO, that is the organization that's supposed to be in charge of the IP worldwide.
Yes, you're right. It's ironic, entirely right. This course, however, may reflect one dimension of the gradual re-engagement by WIPO with this overall landscape. Lisa.
Hello, everyone. Lisa from Ghana. And I have two questions. One has to do with the lecture slides, the lectures, the recorded lectures. First, I noticed from the Copyright X that there were transcripts available. I don't know if one will be available for this Patent X. And then also, if I'm correct, the US system actually has the enforcement has to do with more of the civil, not criminal. And I don't know how that is working or how that works. So if you can illustrate or elaborate on that. Yes, please. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. All very good questions. So with respect to the first, I will, as I indicated in response to Misty's question, make the slides available. I will put them up this afternoon for both the first and the second recorded lectures. And as we proceed through the course, I will continue to make the slides available. Incidentally, this is an important technical point here is as I add things to the course, it means I'm modifying the syllabus. When you sign into the syllabus, you should periodically refresh your browser or reload the page, because otherwise it's likely to show you a pre-existing version and you won't see the links to the slides. So periodically refresh your browser and you will, and as I say, by this afternoon, I'll put the slides up. Now, as to transcripts, okay. So Lisa, it sounds like you have taken the Copyright X course, which is the predecessor to this one. And in Copyright X, there are indeed transcripts. Those transcripts were not prepared by me, however. They were prepared by third parties. First, an organization in New Zealand that put them together, and then there was another group of students put together another set of transcripts and so forth. So I didn't create them. Why didn't I create them? Because I think the audiovisual medium is better because I can show you a lot of diagrams. But I don't object to transcripts, but I don't make them myself. Now, as you may have noticed, I will be over the arc of this course periodically updating the lectures to make them current. That means that transcripts, if they're going to be produced, would have to be done in very short order, meaning to catch up to the revisions I'm making in the lectures as we go along. So it's possible, it would be great if someone wanted to do it, but I have not done it and don't currently have plans to do it. Okay, unfortunately, I've forgotten your third question. Can you tell me it again?
Yes, I was asking about the US system. It's more of enforcement has to do with more of the civil.
Yes, okay.
Criminal, so.
Yeah, that's a great question. In the United States, and in most countries, there is no criminal penalty regime for patent violations. It's entirely civil. But you're right in pointing out that some jurisdictions do have criminal penalties. And so when we get to the remedies section, which is week 7, I will address the option of criminal enforcement. It's not a big deal globally, but it does exist. And so I'll address it in week 7 when talking about remedies. Okay, so
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. So I see there are a couple of questions in the chat, so let me take a couple of them. So here we have a question from JMs. Two unrelated questions. The list of countries' uniform patent system is stated as 197. This is a combination of white. The answer to JM's first question, which concerns how many countries have patent systems, is, I hope in the lecture, I didn't indicate 197. It's 188, as best I can count. 197 is the total number of jurisdictions in the world that might have patent systems, not the number that do. So as I suggested in the recorded lecture, 188 is a little bit squishy as a number, because some of the patent regimes of a few countries, although they're on the books, don't seem to be active. So it's an approximation. 188 is an approximation. Okay, number two, are there any latest cases in the United States for resolving patent infringement disputes between non-contracting parties resolved by arbitration instead of patent court litigation, as in the US, as USA, Singapore, and Hong Kong are the only jurisdictions where patent validity or invalidity and infringement disputes can be submitted to arbitration by the party's consent? There are not many judicial opinions addressing the ambit of arbitration, but there definitely are lots of arbitration awards. Are we going to be covering this in the course? I don't know. Let me think about that. You're right. It's a very important from a business standpoint. Let me give some more thought into whether I can include. I don't currently address this in any of the recorded lectures, but let me give some more thought about whether it makes sense. Okay. Next on our list is Razan. Am I pronouncing?
Hello. Yes, correctly. Yes. So I'm Razan. I work for Medicine Patent Pool based in Geneva. So first, thank you, of course, for all the lectures and all the efforts that it was put in. So I just have a question for the first week lectures, which is about the PCT International Search Report. It was mentioned very briefly. So if you could just clarify it a little bit, if possible, that would be great.
So the machinery of the PCT search report is discussed more by the WIPO representative who provided a brief lecture on this topic. So that's Matt Bryan. He's got a brief presentation on this score. The short answer to your question is that the International Search Report is intentionally incomplete. It's brief. It doesn't purport to be a comprehensive evaluation of novelty and inventive step requirements. You can think of it as be a little bit of an exaggeration to say it's cursory, but it is intentionally incomplete. And as a result, it leaves to the relevant jurisdictions to which the PCT application is forwarded primary responsibility for assessing, especially novelty and inventive step. And that's confirmed by the fact that opposition procedures and post-grant opposition procedures, like the IPRs in the United States, are also directed to the national offices, or in Europe, to the EPO, rather than channeled through Geneva. So I hope that's adequate. If you have more specific questions, I know Matt is very interested. He's the expert on the machinery PCT, and he can provide more detail. So if you want more, send me an email and I'll forward it to him. He can provide it.
Perfect, thanks.
Sure. Incidentally, I'm very glad that you and your colleagues from the Medicines Patent Pool are joining in this course. For the benefit of the rest of you, the Medicines Patent Pool has been critical as an organization that facilitates voluntary licenses by pharmaceutical firms, primarily, to generic manufacturers for the purposes of providing at low prices drugs in developing countries. As we'll be discussing in week 8, the Medicines Patent Pool was crucial in facilitating the reduction in the prices of AIDS drugs and curbing the pandemic in Africa, primarily sub-Saharan Africa. So the engagement of the MPP in this field is very important, and I hope you will help educate the group as a whole when we get that stage. Okay, then here's one question from the chat from Kirti Minhas. Question is about the IP strategy of Apple from the case study. Can we talk about the different IP strategies that Apple used to maintain profits? Sure. So I take it from Kirti, from your question, that your group did discuss the Apple case study. Not all groups did. This is, again, one of the issues that is left to the discretion of your trainer. So to briefly review for the benefit of those who might not have encountered the Apple case study, Apple is today the most valuable company in the world. It went through three phases of in its business strategy and profitability. In phase one, it was a startup and was quite successful as a startup. In phase two, it almost went bankrupt. And in phase three, it rose from the ashes and became the most profitable company in the world. The primary reason for the near disaster in the middle section of its history is that Apple pursued the first of the five offensive strategies available to a patentee. And that strategy is to use the patent to suppress competition, raise prices to monopoly levels, and reap generous profits during the duration of the patent. That's what Apple did. And it made a lot of money as a result, but neglected in so doing the principle of network externalities. And what that means as a practical matter is that Apple's managers ignored the fact that by extracting monopoly profits, they would shrink their market share, make a lot of money, but have a small market share. And that in turn would prompt application, the coders who wrote the software for applications that would run on the computers, to prefer to write for IBM clones because they had a larger market share and therefore more people would be interested in using their software. And as more and more software was available for PCs, IBM clones, then more and more people wanted to buy PCs because they had better portfolios of applications. And Apple's market share shrank further. So this was a death spiral. This would have killed the company. In much the same way that Sony gradually, but in the end permanently, lost its share of the VCR market as everybody shifted from Sony Betamax tapes to VHS tapes. There was going to be only one winner in that market, and it was not Sony. So Apple almost suffered the same fate. What saved the company was not a new strategy for microcomputers. What saved the company was the development of the iPod and then the iPhone. And when deploying the iPod and the iPhone, Sony did not use monopoly pricing. Apple did not use monopoly pricing. Instead, Apple was careful to attend to markets for complements. That's music for an iPod, and that's all the applications that run on a smartphone for the iPhone. And that worked. So that's a short summary of a complicated set of considerations that first almost killed Apple, and second saved it. Lorenzo Banti, I probably got your name wrong, so please correct me if I do.
Lorenzo. Good morning, Professor, and good morning, everyone. I think we're from Italy. And I have a very quick question. I would like to ask whether you have already decided on the modalities of examination.
So again, what have you decided about what?
How the exam will take place.
The exam obviously comes at the end of the course, approximately 10 days after the end of the course. And it will be what in the United States is referred to as a take-home exam, meaning that you don't have to go to a particular location in order to take it. You can do it at home. And you will be submitting your answers to WIPO, and it will be graded by one of the trainers, but not your trainer. So the exam submissions are randomized so that you're not evaluated by your own teacher, which is to avoid favoritism. And then borderline exams, meaning exams that are on the edge of passing or failing, I will review. That's the procedure. I will be posting on the website for the course links to some of the exams I have given in the past that will give you some idea of format and difficulty. I can predict, on the basis of analogous experiences in the past, that roughly 80% of the people who take the exam pass it. And generally speaking, as best I can tell from anecdotal information, everyone who takes the course conscientiously, meaning watches a recorded lecture and takes notes and thinks about the material, can pass it. It's only those who don't end up taking it conscientiously that do not. So that's all for now. As I say, I will post some examples of the previous exams, and later in the course, at an appropriate time, we can talk about it some more, but that's an initial indication.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay, so now I have another question in the chat. This from, which I trust all of you can see. This is from Pratik Kavora from India, a registered patent agent working the IP department of a private pharmaceutical company. Okay, so this is a good example. Pratik is a very experienced person in the patent system. And it's wonderful that he and his colleagues are involved in the course because of their sophistication will enrich our discussions. Okay, number one, in module number one recorded lectures, you explain there's an option with infringer or patentee to file suit in either district courts or the court of appeals in the patent enforcement system. Then what's the difference between the two? Okay, so When filing an infringement suit in the United States, there is only one option. That's to file in a district court, not the Court of Appeals. So the option to file in the Court of Appeals or the Federal Circuit only arises when you are challenging a negative ruling by the patent office concerning whether to grant a patent in the first instance, not for infringement. So infringement always begins in a district court. As I explained in the recorded lecture, the options of which district court to file suit in has been narrowed significantly in recent years by the Supreme Court. But there still remain typically a few district courts that you can choose among, but it has to be a district court. Maybe that's the first question. Second question, who manages the International Trade Court and is it available in other countries than US solo? Who manages it? Well, it has its own set of commissioners who run it and decide cases. Appeals from it go to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. It has as its principal advantage that it's quick, it's faster than infringement litigation. Its principal disadvantage is that it only can issue exclusion orders. It can't affect domestic distribution of infringing products, nor can it order damages. And the question then, is it available in other countries than the US solo? Well, the ITC, the International Trade Court, is only a US phenomenon, but there are other analogous systems available in other jurisdictions for enforcing the right of a patentee to prevent importation of products that either infringe or were produced by an infringing process. So when we get to the infringement section of the course, which will be week six, I will be discussing some of the analogous systems in other jurisdictions. Then number three, if possible, please provide emphasis on European patent litigation, which you explain in module one recorded lectures. I'm not entirely sure what that means. I will be, during the course, describing European patent litigation and juxtaposing it with the United States, Japan, Korea, and China, and so forth. But that's a promise for the future. I can say now that, as I think I mentioned in the recorded lecture, the biggest difference between litigation in Europe. Well, back up for a second. As of right now, patent litigation in Europe is done in the national courts of the member countries of the European Patent Convention. Later this year, we are likely to see, finally, after a very long wrangle, the emergence of a unified patent court. A single court with different levels that will enforce European patents throughout the, or at least be capable of enforcing European patents throughout the entire jurisdiction. But that will be a brand new institution. For the time being, as I say, litigation occurs in national courts. What those national courts have in common is that none of them uses juries, whereas in the United States, most, not all, but most patent infringement suits are tried to a jury. And that has myriad implications for how cases are presented, the kinds of experts that are hired, and so forth. So as the course unfolds, we'll be discussing the roles played for better and worse by juries in the United States and judges in most other jurisdictions, including European jurisdictions. Okay, it's back to the live. Evgeny?
Good morning, Professor, and everyone. Dear Professor, my name is Evgeny Shtin. I work as intellectual property counsel in IT company, and I have the following question. In the lecture of this week, you mentioned that the development of patent law could be divided into three parts: expansion, harmonization, and contraction. And my question is it possible in the future that, for example, part number one, expansion, could be expanded to some new areas like artificial intelligence or maybe some futures subject matters? And more broad question, could you share maybe your vision or your forecast about development of patent law in the nearest future or maybe in 10 or 20 years? Thank you.
So the answer to the first question is yes. I think it's likely that the third phase of the history of subject matter coverage, which, as you rightly indicate, involves contraction in developed countries of the set of inventions that are patentable, it's likely that that third phase will be short-lived, and that the long-term dynamic of expansion of the coverage of the patent system will probably resume. It will not be as overwhelming or as fast as it was in the 20th century, but it will probably resume. And the area that we are likely to see resumption of expansion involves software. So both the US and the EU are currently in a muddle about software, about the degree to which innovations in the field of software are protected. And there is likely to be a resolution in both of those jurisdictions through legislation rather than adjudication that will resume the broad historical trend of expansion. With respect to artificial intelligence, well, there are many questions lurking under the heading of artificial intelligence. so long as there's a person who programs a computer and sets up a regime of artificial intelligence, then the products thereof will definitely be patentable. The degree to which those patents are assigned to people or organizations is a little unclear, but again, we're likely to see a resolution of that in favor of patentability one way or another. My colleague, Ruth Akedici, who helped to put together this course, recently chaired a panel, the National Academy of Sciences, on intellectual property protection of artificial intelligence. And I might ask her later in the lecture series to do a brief presentation on her recommendations, or at least provide a link to the National Academy's report in this regard. Okay, so that's an answer to your first question. So it's a long-winded way of saying yes. The trend toward expansion is likely to resume. Your second question is, how more generally is patent law likely to evolve in the near future? Well, that's a very big question. It has lots of dimensions. I'll mention only one of them. As I indicated in the recorded lecture, the large majority of patents are currently held not by individuals, but by firms and private corporations usually. Well, typically, those corporations are very sensitive to the aggregate costs of securing patent protection in multiple jurisdictions. And they want to reduce it. And they put pressure on their country representatives to try to reduce costs. And one way of reducing costs is to limit the number of jurisdictions. So you are likely to see in the near future the increasing strength of regional organizations like the European Patent Convention or OAPI and ARIPO in Africa that will be invested with greater capacity to issue patents in multiple countries. So that's my prediction, for what it's worth, is that you will see a continuing trend toward harmonization, not through another round of multilateral agreements like TRIPS, but rather through the strengthening of regional organizations like ARIPO and OAPI. So many more issues will arise in the course of the course, but that's not for now.
Thank you for that answer.
You're welcome. So one of the notes in the chat indicates there's no sound. I trust that most of you are able to hear the conversation. So I'm afraid that this note is probably specific to your computer. Okay, here's another question from the chat. Elif Aykurt Karaka, an IP examiner and National IP Office in Turkey. Welcome. I'd like to ask whether ITC decisions are binding like the district courts. I mean, do they have the same strength in terms of enforcement with the district courts? Thank you and kind regards. No, they don't. They don't bind the courts in infringement litigation. So another respect in which they are in the long run less powerful than district court decisions. I see two other notes here saying there's no sound, which is very troubling. I'm afraid that there's not much I can do about that. Could those of you who are able to hear just use the reaction function to give a thumbs up if you can hear? Yeah, okay. So, all right. So it seems the large majority of you are getting sound just fine, but some are not. And as to this, I'm afraid I can't do anything about it, at least on the spot. One participant in the chat says, in case it helps, my computer pushed an update to me today and I needed to restart my computer to enable audio again. A disadvantage of relying on technology, but that's probably a good suggestion for those of you who don't get sound. I'll refer this to the WIPO folks. In hopes that they can correct it before we have another meeting. Peter, I think you're next on the list.
Yes, good morning, Professor Fisher, mm-hmm. and good morning, everyone. My name is Peter. I work at a technology transfer office in a university in the Philippines. And I had two questions, both of which are about the lecture C for week one enforcement and challenging. The first one is about, I wanted to better understand declaratory judgments. You talked about them as an offensive, a way to be more offensive with regards to responding to potential infringement. And you talked about how in order to file such a suit, a patentee must at least make a credible threat of filing an infringement suit, and I want to understand what that might mean. Like, what might what might trigger someone to file such a suit? And then my second question is about the PTAB. There was a part of the discussion that talked about the rates at which claims are deemed invalid at the PTAB. And the comment you raised there was that the rates of settlements are high, but if they don't settle, then the rate at which the challenge claims are deemed invalid are high. And I wanted to ask whether that has any effect at all or on the perception of whether, you know, granted patents are in general, can you still rely on decisions of the USPTO in that sense, or has that somehow eroded trust in granted patents?
Okay, those are two good questions. They're both technical, but they are important. There's feedback from someone right now. I think if everybody could mute their, great. I think it's going away. We'll proceed. Okay, so in answer to your first question, declaratory judgments is a tool that used to be used with some frequency in the United States, is substantially less. We have a child in the background of one of the participants, which is endearing, but probably distracting. So if you could mute your microphone, that'd be great. What's a declaratory judgment action? Well, typically it's filed by a firm that expects to be a defendant in a patent infringement suit. And what it seeks is a declaration from a court that the patent at issue is invalid. That's usually its objective. A peculiarity of the US judicial system is that US courts, including district courts, are only able to address so-called cases and controversies, meaning actual disputes. They are not allowed to give what are called advisory opinions. That's true of the federal courts. It's not true of state courts, but federal courts is where patent litigation occurs. So that means a potential defendant is only able to use this tool if the plaintiff has rattled the saber enough to make it likely that a actual case or controversy is going to arise. So how much saber rattling is necessary? Unfortunately, there's no crisp answer to that. The United States Supreme Court recently issued an opinion which was distressingly vague. But a simple example is if you, as a patentee, write a cease and desist letter that contains a threat to initiate litigation, that's probably going to be enough. Now, one of the reasons why declaratory judgment, back up one step. Why would you, as a defendant, want to file a declaratory judgment action? Why don't you just wait until the patentee brings suit? The answer is that you want to control which jurisdiction hears the case. There are, unfortunately, in the United States, more patent-friendly jurisdictions and less patent-friendly jurisdictions. The Eastern District of Texas, in particular, is very patent-friendly. And so if you're a defendant, you would rather that the litigation be concentrated in some other venue. That's why you would use this particular tool. It's used less often now than it used to be because, as your second question indicates, the IPR procedure, inter partes review, is an alternative and less expensive path for a potential defendant to challenge the validity of a patent. Immediately after the adoption of the American Invents Act, which created this IPR procedure, the rates at which patents were either partially or wholly invalidated by the PTAB were very high, much higher than most observers expected. And that did indeed corrode widespread faith in the validity of patents. Now, it's a little misleading because there's a selection bias here. It's only the patents that were especially vulnerable that were challenged. So that the rates were so high does not indicate that all patents are fragile. It's rather an indication that defendants had a pretty good idea of which ones were fragile. The rates of invalidation have gradually been coming down. Still pretty high, but they've been gradually diminishing. So now stepping back from the details, I want to emphasize a broad theme here. It is widely believed, and I think accurately believed, that US patents are weaker than the patents in many other jurisdictions. Premier example here is Germany. Weaker in the sense that they are more likely to be invalidated if challenged. So is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, I raise in the recorded lecture, I discuss briefly the debate on this issue. There are some commentators who think it's not terrible that the US Patent Office grants patents more readily than other jurisdictions because their validity can always be tested in litigation. On the other hand, the critics of the US regime think that that's a bad idea because it forces defendants to spend a lot of money challenging weak patents, and it disadvantages small enterprises who don't have the necessary usual resources. So as we go through the balance of the course, the merits of the different jurisdictions will keep coming up. Onyekachi, I'm probably mispronouncing your name. Please correct me if I've got it wrong.
That's me. Hello, Professor. Good afternoon here in Nigeria. My name is Onyekachi. I'm a staff of the Patent and Design Registry here in Nigeria. So my question borders on substantive search, because I realize that in Africa, you have just a few patent offices that conduct search as a substance. And then what struck me about your lecture was how you regarded such patents. You know, they could be perceived as weak, not being examined properly. And so they could fail as a matter of time, based on test of time and all that. So what I'm asking this question for is, how do we help Africa as a continent? How do we get upgraded? What needs to be done for a patent office to actually have examiners who can conduct search as to substance in order to add value to the patent system here in Africa, especially Nigeria, because Nigeria is a big market, and not just be a depository, because what it is Nigeria is more or less a depository for patents coming from abroad. Thank you.
So that's a very good and very difficult question. For the benefit of the other members of the course who are listening here, Oyekachi is entirely right that most jurisdictions in sub-Saharan Africa currently do not have substantive examination. And so as a result, they, at least in theory and sometimes in practice, do issue patents without the same close scrutiny that the US, European Patent Office, Japan, Korea, and China more or less in post. So how to change, her question is how can the situation be changed? Well, the first thing that has to happen is that, I'm not sure if this is first, but an important thing that has to happen is that the companies that would be disadvantaged by the imposition of a substantive search requirement have to stop pressuring the relevant governments. So an anecdote here is several years ago, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, South Africa was considering imposing on a subset of patent applications a substantive examination requirement. And the drafters of the report recommending this came to Washington, D.C., and Professor Okedechi and I attended a meeting in the home of the South African ambassador to the United States, where the drafters of this report presented their recommendations. And there was a lot of people, there were a lot of people there, and many of them, some of them, were representatives of firms, pharmaceutical firms in particular. And they resisted the report, arguing that the adoption of a substantive examination requirement would deprive them of vested rights, which struck Professor Okedechi and me as an unreasonable position. After all, South Africa was just considering adopting essentially the same system. It's already in place, as I indicate, in most developed countries. So one of the impediments to the adoption of the regime that you identify is that the firms have to stop using their leverage to discourage the relevant jurisdictions from adopting substantive examination processes. Okay, that's one requirement, one necessary step forward. Another is, to be blunt, funding. It costs money to hire the examiners who are necessary to conduct substantive patent review. And that money has to come from somewhere. It could come from the governments of the relevant jurisdictions, although they often don't have great financial resources. Another possibility is for non-governmental organizations to fund the hiring of examiners. Another possibility is for the firms to fund them. So some years ago, I was providing some advice to countries in Central America. And in one of them, the trademark office was functioning poorly. And the firms who had an interest in a more refined and expedited system combined to put up the money necessary to finance the improvement of the agency. So that's another possibility. Last but not least is as more reliance on regional patent systems. Now, Nigeria is the largest country in terms of population in Africa. It doesn't itself really need to depend upon regional organizations, but it could. So ECOWAS, of which Nigeria is a member, could combine the forces of its relevant countries to try to overcome the financial hurdle here. So none of these suggestions is even in combination likely to be sufficient, but they're probably necessary, if not sufficient, to establish a system of the sort you described. Okay. Looking now at the chat, Harun asks, can you please tell us what are the 20 sections in the PatentX course so we can choose one of them? So this issue is managed entirely by WIPO, not by me. So WIPO has created 20 sections, hired, as you know, 20 teachers, all of them experienced in intellectual property. I trained them last September, but I do not have responsibility for choosing them, nor do I have responsibility for assigning students to particular sections. So, so that's a question that is best directed to the representatives of WIPO, some of whom are likely participating in this call. Some of you may well have attended the seminar that was offered Monday by Samiksha and Lucille, which was intended to make it possible for those who missed their first group meetings to avoid being disadvantaged. If you were in that group, there were 50 people who attended that seminar. The representatives of WIPO should be contacting you shortly, and to ensure that you are assigned to a group that meets your scheduling needs. So if you've not been contacted already, I would expect you to be contacted sometime today. So the bottom line is it's up to WIPO. Okay, back to the list. Alina, I think you're next. Alina, are you still there?
Yes, can you listen?
Now we can hear you, yes.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have a problem with the video. I'm from Cuba, professor of the University of Havana. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, professor. I have a question in relation to the global patent system. You mentioned the possibility to have in the future the global patent system, but I'm wondering because we are developing countries suffering from the lack of capacity building in our patent examiners. But it's the same for the courts, for the judges. What's your opinion about the possibility to have in the future the global patent system and how to develop capacities in our countries? My question is in relation to the question from Nigeria. So I would like to hear your opinion about this issue. Thank you so much, Professor.
That's a very good question, and you're right that it is related to Anikachi's question about Nigeria. So there is, as you point out, a group of scholars and a group of businesses that would favor the creation of a single global patent, not exclusive. So inventors who only wish to secure patent protection in a single country could still just get a national patent. But companies that wanted global patent protection could go to this new entity. So there are two questions. Is it going to happen and should it happen? The answer to the first question is no, not in our lifetime. It will not occur. why? Because there are too many interests throughout the world committed to national sovereignty and would not surrender this degree of power to a global system. The PCT, the Patent Cooperation Treaty, that facilitates the acquisition of national patents is probably as far as we are likely to go toward the creation of a global system. And a single unified global patent regime is not going to happen, certainly during my lifetime, maybe during yours. Okay, separate question. Should it happen? Well, that's a complicated issue. On the one hand, there would be significant efficiency gains for everyone if you had a single regime and a single serious substantive examination of patent applications. There would definitely be a benefit there. On the other hand, patent laws is probably already apparent and will become increasingly apparent as we go through the course, affects many aspects of each country's economy and society. And the adoption of a global patent is likely not to be very sensitive to variations in national interests. The example of those separate national interests is going to be especially prominent in this course is access to medicines. So currently, as we will see as we go through the course, countries, especially but not exclusively developing countries, have a fair amount of flexibility in adjusting their patent systems so as to facilitate access to medicines. And the adoption of a global patent regime would likely limit that. So it's a complicated question whether a global patent system would be a good idea. On the one hand, to repeat, it would be efficient and would save a lot of resources. On the other hand, it would likely disadvantage developing countries, particularly, but not exclusively in the area of access to medicines. So, in against this backdrop, the most plausible way of engaging in capacity building is courses like this. It's creating global networks of teachers, of which you are definitely one, who can have conversations and about the patent regimes in each jurisdiction and learn from one another and gradually build capacity, or more than gradually build capacity, within each jurisdiction. I hope that helps. David.
Thank you very much, Professor, and hello everyone who is on the call today. Professor, you explained clearly about the examinations that shall be conducted at the end of the course. Now, my question is on logistics. During the weekly seminars, is there any assessment that takes place in the course of those seminars? For example, are the students assessed based on their participation, the level of their participation, the level of activity in those weekly seminars? I would be glad if you could kindly briefly comment on this. Thank you.
The course requirement is that each student actively participate in 10 of the 12 weekly seminars. That means not just log in to the seminar, but be available to answer questions, participate in polls, and so forth. So your teacher, the teacher of each group, is keeping track of who comes and verifying that that person is actually there to participate. Above that level, no. The quality of the student's engagement is not being assessed. And there's a reason for that. The reason is that honest discussion of difficult issues would be hampered if the teacher were at the same time assessing the quality of each student's intervention. So the answer is no. There is no assessment of the quality of participation, just the fact of participation.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Onyekachi, your hand is still up. Is that, do you have another question, or is that, as they say, a legacy hand?
Yes, Professor Fisher, I do have another question. Sorry, I forgot to ask at once.
Okay.
This time it borders on patent information. So I'm actually interested in how we can actually unearth patent information for the development of Africa. This is a great area that and I'm interested in it and looking into it, researching to see all of that. However, we can't deny the fact that it's going to raise issues one way or the other, because the fact that patent and most of all the IPs are territorial in nature, you find out that most people abroad, Europe, US, their patents are registered over there. They don't bother about the biggest market, especially Nigeria. And then you find that if we introduce this concept that people, researchers, especially in clusters, can actually benefit from patent information to, you know, either improve what is already existing or actually, you know, create something close to that, put in the market, issues could be raised, you know? So I want to know your opinion as to this. How can this be navigated? And what do you advise? Thank you so much.
Okay, that's another good question. So, as you point out, one of the functions of the patent system is to make technical information concerning what is necessary and sufficient to build a new product or run a new process publicly available. So with rare exceptions now, patent applications to major jurisdictions in the world are published after 18 months. And in theory, the information contained in those patent applications and the eventually issued patents provides a repository of technical knowledge that people all over the world can use to build new products and introduce them into new markets. Because they are publicly available, the informational value of those patents is not confined to the jurisdictions where they are issued. So all US patents, all European patents, all Chinese patents and so forth are publicly available and can be accessed, for example, from people from Nigeria. And the information therein can be used to develop new products and introduce into the Nigerian market. So viewed from this standpoint, the enrichment of the Nigerian patent system is actually not necessary in order to facilitate the harnessing the knowledge that the patent system generates. However, as we will discuss in more detail in week three, in practice, this system does not work as well as it's supposed to. And even though formally, every patent application is supposed to be adequate to enable a person having ordinary skill in the relevant art to practice the invention, in truth, that doesn't always occur. Perhaps the clearest example of that is the, as we'll discuss later in the course, is the mRNA COVID vaccines, which are all patented. The information provided in the patents is not sufficient to enable other jurisdictions to manufacture and distribute the vaccines, forcing countries like South Africa, for example, to reverse engineer the mRNA platform at substantial cost. So there are various proposals, which we will discuss in week three, for addressing this problem, but it's a serious problem now. And as I say, it's not limited to Nigeria, it's a problem in all patent systems. The inadequacy of the public revelations of the technical knowledge. So you also ask a much broader question related to your first question is, how can the patent regimes in developing countries and African countries in particular be enhanced? So there's no simple answer to that. Along the way, I will be trying to identify ways of enriching the patent systems of developing countries in general and African countries in particular. And Professor Okedichi, who also happens to come from Nigeria, will be doing the same. We are currently, or have in the past, providing some advice to on this issue to some governments in Africa, in particular Namibia, Malawi, Kenya, South Africa. I have no contacts in Nigeria, but Professor Okedichi does. And we are doing what we can as a practical matter to help on the front that you identify. Okay, so it looks like we have no more folks in the active queue, and we have run out of time. So I will make the recording of these conversations available. And as I say, I will commit to doing one of these office hours every week. They will be focused, as this one does, primarily on the material covered in the preceding week, but I'm also happy to answer more general questions as we go along. And I will to go back to one of the issues raised right at the beginning, make available on the website for the course the slides for the first two recorded lectures this afternoon. In the meantime, if you have any other questions about logistics, and above all, if you have not been yet assigned to a group whose schedule is satisfactory, please let me know promptly, because it's crucial that we get that settled now so you can participate fully in the course. So I hope to see at least some of you again next week, and I hope you continue to benefit from the materials. Bye for now.
Thank you very much, Professor. Have a great day.
Thanks, Professor. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Bye, Professor.
Thank you, Prof.
Thank you, Professor, so much.
If you want to get a package, the demand will come out.